Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is Africa changing, and what future is in store for this vast continent and its almost 900 million residents? While we hear a lot about horrific violence, political strife, ethnic tensions, and the scourge of AIDS in dozens of Africa's 53 nation states, my guest today insists the privations suffered by millions of Africans are hardly the whole story. Richard Dowden first lived in Africa in 1971 when he moved to Uganda to work as a teacher during the dictatorship of Idi Amin. Later, he worked all over the continent as Africa editor for The Independent and later The Economist. Today, he serves as director of the Royal African Society and has just published a new book called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. Richard, welcome to Think.
Hello. Good morning, Chris.
You write that today two Africas coexist. How would you describe them and what separates them?
Well, I think there's the Africa that we see on the news, which is disaster, death, disease. But it's not the whole picture, because there is an ordinary Africa. I would quickly say it's not doing as well as it should do, but it's an Africa that survives, is strong, and I think I'm very optimistic about it. I think it will pull through, and that it and this is quite a very dynamic Africa, and we see very, very little of that reported in the news.
There would be people who argue that there's no way to sort of focus on the positive things in Africa because there is so much wrong going on. But I wonder if you can talk about how much of the information we get about Africa ultimately is filtered through aid organizations, which, while very well-meaning, certainly have a position on how Africa is.
Yeah, sure. I'm speaking as a journalist who's been doing it for a long time, and if I say, look, I want to go to Botswana, it's doing okay. It's a country that's doing quite well, and I'll write a few pieces about it. I'm not going to get, the editor's going to say, you must be joking. If I say, there's this terrible famine breaking and this terrible war with murder, rape going on, he'll say, oh, that's a good story, because that's what journalism is about, and it's difficult to get away from that. You can't write a story about another quiet day in a country doing well. And I think that's where the aid agencies come in, because they often facilitate journalists' trips. They often provide transport, a translator, an interpreter, and so the whole of Africa is seen through the eyes of the aid agencies. And I'm not saying they're untruthful, but their job is to raise funds to do what they do, which is to help people in trouble and so on. And therefore, they need the worst possible images in order to raise that money. And I think I've seen that. I mean, if it works, it's good. But I've seen it exploited ruthlessly sometimes by aid agencies who simply want to get horrific pictures on TV so that they can raise funds. And that is telling a false story of Africa.
What would you consider Africa's greatest advantages in the 21st century?
I think it's people. It's got a very young population and a very enthusiastic population. I mean, I took my family there on holiday, actually back to Uganda a couple of years ago. And after a couple of days, I said, "What do you notice?" And they couldn't believe the number of children in all sorts of school uniforms, blues, reds, greens, oranges, walking, trying to get to school. And I think that's the sort of, you think, wow, this is a country that really wants to go places. And that's where I think my optimism ultimately lies.
What did you know about Africa, Richard, when you first went there after finishing school to work?
Ooh, very, 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 very little. I was very idealistic. But I knew what I wanted to do was to try and live with people in a different culture. And what happened was that I found myself prevented from doing that from the people. No, you're a white man, and therefore you have to live according to that sort of style. And while they would welcome you into their homes, you couldn't actually, they wouldn't let you live with them. And I think this is one of the things I picked up very early on, a split in Africa's psyche, I suppose, of not sure whether they wanted to go on living in their traditional ways and believing in their culture or making a grab for a Western lifestyle. And it often led to disaster when this lack of self-confidence in the past, lack of belief in Africa, was accompanied by this sort of grab for instant wealth, instant Western wealth. And I think that's been a problem that was created by the whole colonial takeover of Africa, and Africa is now recovering from that, but it takes a long time to work through.
It is, of course, impossible to consider Africa without acknowledging the vast differences between its many different dozens of separate countries. But I wonder if it's possible to identify a sort of pan-African culture.
Yeah, it's difficult. Every time you open your mouth and you say Africa and you make a sweeping generalization, you know, Africans, I can almost feel, you know, Africans. I mean, that's not true of where we live. So you have to, you say, okay, there will always be exceptions. What would I say were generalizations? Well, I would say a very strong sense of community. This is the stuff, again, that doesn't come out very well in the disaster reporting. It's the way when a community is attacked, people support each other, help each other in a way I'm not sure would happen in the Western world. I think that's one thing, a deep spiritualism. I think in all the time I've worked in Africa, I think I've only met three atheists. Everybody is, they may be a member of a church or a mosque or whatever, but there is also a sense of the spiritual dimension of the world. And that has pluses and minuses. I mean, it gives you a great self-confidence, a great confidence to survive bad times. But there's a slight lack of agency sometimes in this. It's beyond our control. There's nothing we can do. It's in we would say, the lap of the gods. They would say the spirits, we've upset the ancestors, and that's why we're being punished. And there's nothing we can do about it. So that cuts both ways. But I think what I notice, I've traveled a bit in Asia, I've traveled in the Middle East, and there's an openness in Africa. You know, it's a sort of hello, how are you? And one of the things that, one of the images of Africa from the outside is, oh, it's all tribal. And in fact, when you get in amongst it and you talk to people, and they will, most Africans will speak three or four languages, their own plus the locals, and English or French or Portuguese, and I'm amazed at the way, considering how different the cultures are in Africa between different ethnic groups, just how well they do get along together for most of the time. And it's really only when the politicians move in and play the ethnic card and blame another ethnic group for the state they're in, that's when it gets bad. But on a day-to-day basis, they're very, very welcoming of other human beings.
It's really interesting when you write in the book about this sort of fatalistic nature that they have, perhaps based on the great role of spirituality. But a lot of Westerners, I think, would be surprised that you also describe African culture as overwhelmingly optimistic. Can you almost understand how that's possible when what we have seen in media accounts is mostly only what's bad?
Well, I started this book 14 years ago, and I kept giving up because I'd gone to bad places in bad times. That's what journalists do. When I was trying to write my stories, I found they were all full of gloom and doom. And then I had this feeling, but it didn't feel like that. In fact, even in the worst of times, in the worst of places, I felt an amazing optimism. And we will get through this. Yes, things are bad at the moment, but we will survive and things will get better. And it was that I then realized was the missing element in the book, and then I was able to finish it. And that is something that's quite remarkable. The human spirit surviving in the worst of times in a way that I just know if it happened where I live in London or almost anywhere else, people would just curl up and die. They wouldn't, you know, they'd be so depressed by it. But I've never come across depression in that way in Africa, in bad times. It actually produces the opposite effect, a great spirit of great strength, a great spirit of survival. And I think that's what makes me ultimately very optimistic about Africa. This this place can, you know, has survived pretty tough times, and Africa is, you know, a tough place to survive in. But there is a terrific human optimism there that it may, you know, in our children's time, it will be better. It will get better.
Interestingly, you've written recently that Africa might actually be spared the deepest impact of the global recession. Can you talk about why?
Well, because much of Africa is good at just getting by, surviving day to day, hand to mouth. Sometimes when the rains don't come or insects come and eat all your crops, then it doesn't. But it's a great place to survive in. I sometimes think, you know, if the bomb dropped, I know where I'd want to be. I'd want to be in Africa. I would be looked after. There would be food. There's a great knowledge of how to get by there. So I think that's one of its great talents is that people just can, you know, you can plant food and grow food, and everybody knows how to do that. And then, because in places like Zimbabwe, they say, oh, this country's about to hit the buffers or go over the precipice. And I always say, no, there's no buffers and no precipices in Africa. What happens in these situations where the politics screw up and people get hurt is everybody just gently sinks to a level of subsistence. And that's what has kept Africa going through the centuries, and that's how they survive.
On the other hand, tighter credit markets globally make it harder than ever for African countries to borrow the money that they need to invest in infrastructure. Could that reality snuff out the positive growth in the places where it's already taken root?
Well, Africa's been growing for the last 5 or 6 years on average at about 5 or 6%. And this is, I mean, there are various reasons for this. One is China. China decided it wants Africa's raw materials, and it's come to get them. And that's pushed the prices up, and that's been terrific for Africa. So there's that element. There are other elements. There's communications, mobile phones, and so on. So trade's much easier. But I think obviously with our demand for China's goods and China's demands for Africa's goods diminishing, then that some of that's going to drop off. But many people have ascribed that growth rate to a new confidence in Africa, that there is the rule of law, that this is a better place to invest. And I see no reason why that confidence should diminish. The fact is that a lot of wars that had really cursed Africa in the 90s have ended, and there are new regimes in place. There's a new push in Africa for international standards, ways of doing business, and so on. And I think that remains. The brutal hard luck is that just as people, investors, were beginning to say, where can we get a return? Everything else is the rates of return are dropping. Let's go to Africa. They're now just pulling their money back because they need cash back home. It's nothing to do with what's happening in Africa. It's because they need the cash back here, and so their investment will diminish. And at the same time, governments will have less to spend on aid. So for no fault of its own, Africa's now being penalized. At the very moment, it's going to take off. But I think I know how many people will react. They won't get depressed or hopeless about it. They'll just say, well, you know, that's the way life is, and we'll just buckle down and tighten our belts and carry on as we usually do.
Richard Dowden is my guest. He's director of the Royal African Society. His new book is called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. We'll return to our discussion in a moment and welcome you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard Dowden. He is director of the Royal African Society, and his new book is called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Richard, why do you think that Asian investors, and Chinese investors in particular, recognized the economic potential of Africa at a time when so much of the West assumed that it was either a quagmire to be avoided altogether or really was only suitable as a target for humanitarian aid?
Well, the simple answer is that Asian countries, China in particular, wanted Africa's raw materials, oil, copper, titanium, all the minerals, and the hardwoods as well. And I found it very amusing in the late 90s, because I had a bit to do with the mining companies, and they were at that time, they were mothballing, or they were just sort of closing down mines. And I always felt that Africa was like a pudding that was too hot to eat. It's a bit dangerous there. It's a bit insecure, so we're not going to go there. We're not worried because it'll stay on the ground and we'll get round to it eventually. And suddenly the Chinese nipped in and ate their pudding. And they were suddenly scrambling to, they were really worried because African governments were very happy to say, no, we'll give it to anybody who'll develop it. And the Chinese came in with huge resources. And of course, the Chinese are quite, their engineers and so on, are quite happy to live in an African way. They don't need air conditioning. They don't need 4x4s. They don't need their kids in private school. They just come and work, and they work very, very hard indeed. And I think a lot of African governments really appreciated that. So they were welcomed there, and they've given African governments a lever to, or a stick to beat the West with. And they say, why can't you do what China's doing, building roads, railways, rehabilitating ports and things like that, and doing a lot of infrastructure things, which governments like. It suddenly made the West's contribution to Africa look rather mean and not very dynamic.
Do you expect India to be the next big push in terms of investment in Africa?
Yes, I think India is coming. It's always been there. It has been. It's much slower, and of course, it's not directed in a way that China's is, because it's not a centralized state. But there have always been links, particularly with East Africa, and now I think some of the very big companies, Indian companies, are moving in. And I think when we wake up from this recession, we will find that the biggest players in Africa will shortly be China and India, and that the influence of the West, both business and in many other ways, will have diminished hugely.
You write that the pace of life is slow in Africa. Can you talk about how that speed plays into the culture?
Well, if you're not in a hurry, it's very, very pleasant. I mean, everybody, just greeting somebody will often take 4 or 5 minutes before you actually engage in a meaningful conversation, just exchanging, how are you? I'm fine. How's the family? They're fine. And it's a very nice, it gives you a very nice feeling to be a human being and just talk to another human being in that warm, very human way, and not in the way we sort of grunt at each other in the morning. But it's a really pleased to see you type of conversation.
There's no sitting next to someone on a train and not talking to them.
Absolutely. I mean, the idea of sitting near to somebody and not acknowledging them, engaging with them, is unthinkable. And often, if you're traveling in one of the very crowded buses, somebody will start to sing, and other people will join in, and that's the way life is. And I often ask Africans who I met in Africa who come to Britain or go to the States, and I sort of say, well, how did you find it? What were the things that you noticed straight away? And they said, the people don't greet each other, they don't talk to each other. They just come in. One guy said to me, he came into the office and greeted everybody as you would in Africa, go around and shake hands with them, and they looked at him as though he was a bit strange. It's that sort of thing. But of course, in another way, You have to be careful with making appointments in Africa because, you know, people have the same sort of attitude, which is, yeah, I mean, midday is any time between sort of 11 and 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And certainly big men, big powerful people will not keep appointments in on principle. They keep any, you know, you keep everybody waiting. So you go and try and meet a minister or something, and there'll be a great queue outside his office of people who may have been waiting for days for a meeting with him. And that's the way you do it. You sit and wait and sit and wait. So it's people who are looking at their watches find it very, very frustrating when they first come to Africa, and they have to get used to this different way of doing things. But I have to say that in the last couple of years, I've seen three or four articles in by African columnists in African newspapers saying, why are we like this? Why don't we turn up on time? Do things the way the rest of the world does. You know, I've got a huge frustration. So I think that culture may be changing, certainly in the cities and in business, and hopefully in time in government as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that speed has put Africa at a disadvantage in terms of trying to fold itself into the global economy fully.
Yeah, the most dramatic expression of it at the moment is the arrival of the Chinese, who, you know, will work a 13, 14-hour day and go to sleep and wake up again and start again, and they'll work 7 days a week. And certainly in Zambia, that was absolutely it was crucial in the troubles in the mines there, and it led to actual violence because the Zambians were being forced to try and keep up with this pace, and they just wouldn't do it. And the union, called them out on strike, and then there were huge problems. So I think that's, there is a problem there. But elsewhere, I've seen people realize, yeah, we have got to change. I can remember going to Nairobi years ago, people would be walking slowly into town in the morning, and there would be no such thing as a rush hour. And suddenly, now you go to Nairobi and everybody's hurrying in there. They're walking, or they're getting on buses. They're big, cute traffic jams. And you just feel the whole culture of that place has changed.
One piece of technology in particular seems to have had an extraordinary power in changing the way even very poor Africans live and work today, and that's the cell phone. Can you give us a sort of before and after assessment of life in a place like Nigeria since cell phones started to become pervasive?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, this with these this culture of going and meeting somebody and sitting and waiting for them. Of course, with cell phones, that's all stopped. Traffic jams in Lagos, for example, go slows as they call them there, they could last up to 6 or 7 hours. People just stuck in traffic, and although the traffic's still very heavy, I've noticed that it's actually diminished. And people say, well, that's because of the cell phone. It just people can call each other and say, okay, I'll leave when you leave, and we'll meet there. And they don't need to make these journeys. And also, there was no proper telephone. The landlines were few and far between, and often didn't work. So the only way of actually getting an appointment, I can remember, you know, this is sort of 15, 20 years ago. You went if you wanted to meet somebody, you went to their house. And you then left a little note saying, I'd like to meet you, and you waited. And then he would send somebody back with a note saying, okay, come at 4 o'clock next Tuesday. And then you would say, no, I can't make that. So there would be a continual sort of going backwards and forwards on this with messengers and so forth. And now, you just one call and you can do it. So it's just transformed life in a place like that. And you see in the markets, the ordinary market women who are, maybe just selling a little pile of tomatoes or oranges or something, they'll have a cell phone and they'll call up their friends in another market and say, what's the price here? Or they'll text them anyway. Texting is the way of communication now. All sorts of ways in which has made business a lot easier. But when the cell phone arrived, they thought, oh, well, it'll be the top sort of 2 or 3% of the country that'll want them. And it's all the ones at the bottom of the pyramid now. You never get into a taxi without the taxi driver giving you his cell phone number. Next time, call me. This is my
I'll
name.
I'll pick you up.
It's quite extraordinary. Everybody has a cell phone now.
And there's even been an effect on democracy, because people are reporting to their friends and family in other parts of the country where they live what's gone on.
Well, that's I witnessed it in Ghana, two elections which I witnessed in Ghana. And the radio stations would call people to report anything that they saw going on that was against the electoral rules. So, and you'd just listen in on the local radio stations, and there would be people calling in and saying, I've just seen, you know, somebody ran off with a ballot box or stuffing a ballot box or doing something like that. And it would be broadcast straight away. And, of course, then people would react and it would stop. So it had a hugely positive effect. And when election results were announced at a polling station, they could be reported straight to the government and then broadcast on the radio, because somebody could actually hold up the cell phone and hear the guy reading out the results. So that was a very positive one. But I have to say there's a negative one in Kenya last year when all that horrible ethnic violence broke out, largely manipulated by the politicians, but it was the politicians who were sending around the mass text messages with nasty, really full of hate language and really stirring people up. So it played a bit of a negative effect there. But on the whole, I think it's really transforming the whole continent.
There is obviously still an extraordinary amount of corruption in so many different African governments. Can Africans thrive even if they're living under corrupt regimes?
They thrive that's not a word I would use. The attitude is get by. I as an outsider, I sometimes feel, why don't you go for the French Revolution solution? Just
overthrow
rise
it
up,
all.
Seize these guys, chop their heads off, and empty their pockets before you do it, because there is the difference between the ordinary people getting by on equivalent of $2 or $3 a day and so on, and these incredibly wealthy political businessmen, if you like, who've just stolen the whole country, is so grotesque. And but it's not an African way. No, we will. There's been very, very few successful prosecutions. But what I think it may be also a bit of a culture of aid, where governments are given aid by Western countries, and they're not, that makes them unaccountable to their own people. And I think if it's when African voters say, no, we are in charge, not the politicians, and we hold them to account, that's when things will start to change. And you can see everywhere it's two step forwards, one step back, but you see that sort of culture is beginning to grow. Again, I'll quote Kenya in the election last year. A lot of the most corrupt people were actually not returned to parliament, in spite of the fact they spent a lot of money on the voters and gave them free beer and food and at rallies and so on. The people ate the food, drank the beer, and then voted against them. And that is real progress.
And in fact, one of the reasons that you identify for so much Western aid coming to very little fruition is that often it is sort of applied by people from the outside without ever consulting with the everyday Africans who would ostensibly benefit from it.
Yeah, I think that's right. My experience is that when African rulers, I hesitate to call them all leaders. I mean, some certainly are, but they're rulers and almost owners of these countries. And they hear the language, the development language that the World Bank talks in, that all the government agencies that have huge sums of money to spend in Africa, and they start writing in that sort of developmentese language. They're sort of singing their song. And so the donors, the aid donors, then say, these are good guys. We'll give them lots of money because they speak our language. But you realize that actually when it when it comes down to it, they're just trying to get the money, and they're not really signed up to those principles, to those values at all. We see this in Kenya all the time. That the government will have its development program and its strategic goals and all of this sort of thing, and when the money arrives, it gets stolen. And the Western donors, because they're then committed to pushing the money out of the door, they don't want to look too closely at actually the final result, because by the time that's assessed, the guy who's actually, or the person who's actually signed the checks will have moved on somewhere else. And you don't get further your career in the World Bank or in any of these agencies by saying, no, I'm not going to give any money. So it's, I think these are the dangers of aid. I don't want to be, I'm not cynical about aid yet. I'm very skeptical about it. And I think we just have to be very, very careful to see how it is spent and what the results actually are, and keep assessing that and watching what happens on the ground, whether it arrives, how it's spent, and how it changes society there. And I think we're lazy about doing that bit of it. We're happy with just to give the money and then leave it.
And just sort of feel better about the effort.
Yeah, because it makes us feel better. Yeah.
Are there particular problems that you would like to see aid directed to, maybe to the exclusion of some others?
There's a bit of me that says, why don't we just concentrate on education, especially for women? If you educate the girls, then when they're mothers, they can already start giving their children literacy, and that's probably the most transformative thing that in anyone's life. But I'm not sure. I mean, certainly, you talk to Africans, and they're very happy with the Chinese at the moment because they're building roads and railways, which have been neglected by donors for a long time, and actually transforming the infrastructure. And for a long time, nobody would touch infrastructure. It was all about health and education and trying to improve the lives of the people.
Richard Dowden is with us. We'll be back with our discussion in just a moment about his new book, Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is a former teacher and journalist, currently director of the Royal African Society, Richard Dowden. His new book is called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find TJ in Plano. Hello, TJ.
Hey, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, thank you guys for covering Africa. I was just going to ask about economic sanctions in Africa. I was wondering if your guest had the opportunity to observe what their impact, their effect on the people's lives in Africa. Do these sanctions work? Because I can think of a few governments that have had economic sanctions imposed on them, and they seem to be doing okay, even the leaders of the country. So I'm just wondering if your guest has sort of observed and seen what these things do to ordinary people in Africa.
Thanks for your call.
Sanctions? Yeah. Well, the ones that I watched very closely were the ones against apartheid South Africa, and it was a long, slow grinding down of the government and the economy there. But it was only when the bankers pulled the plug on South Africa that things really began to move. So they weren't that effective. I'm trying to think where else sanctions have been applied. Certainly when Nigeria was suspended from the British Commonwealth, or that hurt, but it wasn't an economic sanction. They were just kicked out of the club, and I think that hurt. I think that hurt their pride, and I think that had an effect. Clearly, the ones on Zimbabwe are not working, because it is The idea was to target, and there are no sanctions against the state of Zimbabwe. It is against individuals who have power there, and the idea was to try and separate them from their money and prevent them from visiting it, if it was in Switzerland or Britain or wherever. But it hasn't really worked because they still remain powerful and they still have access to a lot of funds, and there is no sign of the sanctions against those individuals actually changing anything in Zimbabwe. So I think it's a difficult tool, and it's a great threat, but I've never actually seen it change anything in reality.
We have an email from Amiso, who says he is originally from Nigeria. He asks, as China and India make their economic inroads into Africa, what are the real and potential problems you see arising from this new economic colonization?
Well, I think I'm not sure if it's economic colonization. I mean, hopefully African governments, African people will remain in control of this relationship. The perception is, and I don't know yet. I think the jury's out on it, but it is a replication of the colonial takeover at the end of the 19th century. What I say is it doesn't have to be like that if governments, African governments, say, no, you can do this, but you can't do that, and they remain in control of it, as they're perfectly capable of doing. The trouble is that the Chinese offer so much money and so many projects that I think many African leaders say, oh, yes, and they don't actually think it through and work out what they really want out of it. I think the big downside, particularly with China, is that since they don't have human rights and democracy as part of their agenda, they don't push it in Africa, and therefore their dealings with governments are, they don't ask what the governments are doing. They have no interest in whether it's oppressing its people, whether it has credibility. It's the government, and that's all they care about. And I think that's going to be a real downside because, of course, if a government has a relationship with China, it benefits hugely from its largesse, from its support. And this has a political effect locally. It weakens democracy. And I think that's the biggest drawback. Though in the longer term, I think China will recognize that if they back bad governments, they're going to lose their own good name as well. And in the long run, they're going to have to make judgments about African governments. I mean, they have to an extent with Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe. And they're not. They used to sell guns. They used to do business. They used to buy mines and so on. And now they're doing very, very little indeed. And they're not taking advantage of its collapse to buy up stuff or invest there or give it aid or anything.
How politically active is this growing African middle class as compared with a place like China, where the middle class seems at least temporarily sort of complacent about politics as long as their material circumstances are improving?
This is the big question, and I don't think there's a simple answer. I've met the middle class, particularly returning diaspora who've come from America or Europe and want to bring back what would be generally recognized as international standards. And some will say, well, that's what I'm doing in my own business. And you say, well, what about in the broader political setup, call it governance, if you like, the way the country's governed? And they say, no, I don't want to get involved in that. I don't want to get involved in the politics. Others are saying, we've got to turn this country around, we've got to make the government accountable, and they are much more involved. So I don't think there's a generalization. But what I've found is that everywhere in those places, like in the business community in Nigeria, they will meet as a little, almost like a little club, and discuss things, and they form a political pressure group to try and get the government to get the right laws in place, get the technical stuff in line so that they can do business better. And, of course, their biggest push is for, you know, you are giving this country, with your corruption and so on, you're giving the country a bad image, and that's got to change because people won't invest here as long as you're doing things badly. And I think that's their biggest card, is to say, you know, no one's going to come and invest in your country as long as you're behaving like this. And I think that's their greatest political involvement, their strongest political card.
You know, the influence of that diaspora, Richard, is a fascinating variable in all of this, because on the one hand, there are remittances going back and building up places that had been very poor before. And on the other hand, there are the best and brightest in Africa who very often decide that their prospects are better outside their own country.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And we've actually campaigned in Britain at the Royal African Society to persuade the government to stop recruiting nurses, teachers, doctors from Africa. They a few years ago there was a shortage, and they were recruiting directly from African countries. And I was saying, you know, look at the ratios. You know, the number of nurses there are in Malawi or South Africa or Zambia compared to Britain, and you're sucking them out of the continent in the place where they're most needed. So now there are lots of schemes to try and get them either to go back or to work with, to go back for a short time as a fully paid, with taking their salary with them. There are all sorts of schemes. So I think what African governments say, well, we can't actually stop people leaving. And I think I just saw recently the Zambian government is saying on the health, in the health service, well, why don't we just treble the number of nurses and doctors that we train and use aid to do that? And if a third of them leave, that's fine, because they'll send back remittances, but we will be able to run our own health service as a result. So we're actually creating them for export in order to send back the remittances, which I think is quite an interesting idea. It's sort of counterintuitive, but it's recognizing the fact they can't actually stop people leaving if they want to. The remittances have been, I think I just saw a World Bank figure of 13 billion. I've seen a figure as high as 20 billion. But what we do know is that's dropping because of the recession in America and in Europe. And that's going to diminish. And the question then is, if Africans lose their jobs in outside the continent, will they just sit it out, living on welfare or whatever, or will they go back and take some of their savings back and say, right, you know, this is the moment, make a virtue of it, and I'm going to come back and reinvest in Africa.
Richard Dowden is my guest. His book is called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. Let's go next on the phones to Clarence in Dallas. Hi, Clarence.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Wonderful, Richard. I'm so glad to hear you today. I pastor a church here in Dallas, First African Freedom Church, as well as in Ghana, West Africa, Reverend Glover, and we're seeing that when we empower the people in Africa, as you said earlier, with things that they can work with, then they begin to develop. I'd like to ask the question, what role do you see African Americans have with Africans on the diaspora going back and building up the country, and how might the President Obama's presidency, being from Kenya, impact the internal development of Africa, given the natural resources that they themselves can produce and process there in Africa, rather than sending to America and to Europe?
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. With the role of African Americans, I feel I'm an outsider here. I suppose I'm a white European. I would say that I look at it, take it the other way. The election of Barack Obama, of an African to the presidency of the most powerful nation on the planet, had a huge effect in Africa. I had so many emails and calls from Africans saying, this is the greatest day of my life. And I think it will give African self-confidence a huge boost. And I spoke earlier about this, I don't know how to describe it, I think a psychologist might call it a wound, this uncertainty in identity, this lack of trust in the culture of Africa in the past, which has bedeviled Africa in the last few years. I've seen this wound closing and healing as more and more Africans, particularly from the diaspora, will be very happy sitting on the ground, cross-legged, eating ugali or you know, the ordinary African food with their fingers and being completely African, and at the same time then getting up and going off to their offices where they're, you know, on the phone to the bank in New York or whatever, and living an international life. And that I've seen, and that didn't exist in the old days. It was very much a choice about whether you wanted to be almost like the white man or you wanted to be an African. And I think you can be both. I think the realization is that you can be both. And that's, I think, hugely important. And they can see that in Barack Obama. And I think his book, Dreams from My Father, opens up that whole issue. And he resolves it clearly for himself, feeling, yes, I can be both. And I think that's the message. And I think African Americans can say, yes, we can. Of course, we can operate in a 21st century industrialized society, and we can operate there perfectly. But we can also celebrate our Africanness with the things I've spoken about, that great sense of community. And I've not spoken about music, but you know, wherever you go in Africa, there is music, music, music. And you realize as you listen to the different themes, they have gifted the world with modern music. All that music that we hear every day actually comes from Africa. So when that realization, that pride in Africa's past really comes through, I think that's the greatest thing that African Americans can bring to Africa, is to strengthen that self-confidence.
Where would you recommend people go, Richard, for accurate information about the development of Africa and the money being spent there that isn't sort of sullied by the lens of only looking at the tragedy of Africa?
I switch every day onto allafrica.com. It's a website that collects all the articles from African newspapers and publishes and puts them on one website. I mean, that you can keep up with individual countries from, but I must admit, that's a good question. I don't know a single place which tracks the development stuff in one place. It's all a bit sort of atomized. You know, there's the World Bank, and then there's, you know, you can go to the individual agencies and so on, but they're all basically promoting this, or, you know, a lot of it's propaganda. And there's nobody monitoring this stuff as it should be monitored. There are one or two little organizations. And there was certainly, after 2005, the idea that churches would do it.
I'm so sorry that we're out of time. The new book is called Africa, Altered States, Ordinary Miracles. Richard, it has been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Chris, thank you very much indeed.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.